Hey, this is RJD2. You're listening to Sound Sessions on WGN Plus. Welcome back to another episode of Sound Sessions. As always, I am Kevin.
And what's up, Kev? I'm Mike.
Michael, we are here backstage at the Metro once again, and absolutely thrilled to be joined by RJD2. RJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just dive right in. The new album, Dame Fortune, I feel like it's got somewhat of a new sound to it. What was the mindset going into the new album?
Well, you know, most of the time when I'm making a record, my number one priority is putting together the best body of songs that I can at any given point in time. So this was no different in that regard. I wasn't really working on like a theme, but a direction for a record usually kind of shows itself after you're four or five or six songs in. So, you know, there's some things like within songs, I feel like there are different concepts or goals or things I wanted to achieve. I was trying to achieve, in terms of the whole album, you know, I was basically shooting for cohesive and, you know, again, another thing that happens for me is I'll make a record, then I'll look back on a record and it's my nature to look at what I've done, not necessarily wrong, but what could I improve upon? Yeah. You know, I'm continually trying to get better at what I do. So sure. This time around, I was looking back on my last solo record and realizing, well, I like all of these songs individually, but as a whole, I don't think this record needs to be, you know, whatever, 14 or 15 songs long. So I was trying to shoot for a little more concise and shorter.
Yeah.
This time around.
Okay. I gotta say, first of all, A New Theory, that's my jam on the album. That song, so good. And I feel like that's got like an edge to it. And the album, I don't want to generalize, but it kind of has an edge to it, you know. And that's what I meant. It kind of has that new feel a little bit. Are you embracing the edge or the aggression a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that definitely, you know, to come back to what I was saying about once the album starts to take shape, then you have you're kind of reacting. Songs are reacting off other songs, and that was definitely an example of something where, you know, I had the drum program put together for that tune, and for the longest time it just sat and I wasn't quite sure where to go with it, and you know, I'd load it up and try to make something interesting and it just wasn't working, and then it kind of in the 11th hour it came together. But I will say that it was a thing that it happened in the context of some of the other songs that were, you know, by the time that I was working on that song, I had already had at least one or two of the more kind of ambient or ethereal pieces under my belt.
Sure.
And some stuff was kind of like a little smoother. And so that's kind of naturally where I go is, well, let's try to provide some contrast. Let's keep it fun and interesting for me. And also hopefully keep it, so it's not just 12 songs that are like the same incarnation of the same vibe, you know?
Sure.
You know, you're talking about the fact that you kind of start these drum programs and stuff like that. Where do you get, like, inspiration from your sound? Because, you know, most of the time it's just coming from, is it coming from just your life in general, but you get this kind of darker feeling, or do you hear something in nature or something like that?
It's funny you mentioned nature. I do feel like a lot of my inspiration comes from feelings outside of music, you know, movies, and, you know, to a lesser degree, just nature, just life experiences inform what I want to do with music. It's not always something as conscious or intended as, here's a feeling I'm trying to capture. What's much more common is I'll start playing around with, you know, chord changes or textural ideas or in that example, you know, an example of A New Theory, a drum program that I know I can, if I can get this right, it can be kind of like an edgy, aggressive tune. And then through working on them, there's feelings within them that I start reacting off of. And then then at that point, the song is a direction and I'm just trying to usher it, that original idea, into the best execution of it. So like I look at the first song as an example of that, is something that you know, I just kind of stumbled across one of the first chord change that kind of that is introduced maybe about 15 seconds into the song. And once I had that, then it was, then something's on the table. Now there's an idea, and I like the, you know, I'm more reacting to the mood of the music as I'm sitting down and trying to create a piece of music that is illustrating some kind of externality or something like that.
Sure. Yeah, because, you know, the good thing about listening to your albums is you can kind of listen to them all the way through and you get a good sense. Like, you can go through these, like, waves of feeling, like, through listening to your albums. Of course, man. Do you aim for that when you make these?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. I feel like it's a blessing and a curse. And, you know, I have a lot of interests, you know, when I'm listening at home. I just have, you know, it can be anything from soul to jazz, yeah. Which I listen to a lot of. I listen to a decent amount of metal. You know, I listen to ambient music. And to me, there's not a, I don't get, you know, it's never, the distinction between, you know, genres is, has never been as that relevant to me. It's more about the musical experience. I mean, there's things that I can get from an Eno record that I can sometimes will get the same feeling from a, you know, I don't know, it's a Metallica record or something, yeah. Or whatever, you know. So that is just naturally reflected in the records that I make, for better or for worse. You know, but there's times where I feel like it's, you know, I'm glad that hopefully other people enjoy that. There's times where I feel like it's, I wish that wasn't, you know, it kind of feels like a curse more than a sure. Blessing at times.
You know, you feel that eclectic sound with your albums and everything. Is there anything that you listen to when you're trying to get inspired that you won't listen to? Is there like a country band or something that you're just like, I'm not going to listen to that today?
I mean, if I'm never not listening to music, it's more, my understanding is more, I haven't found a thing in this that resonates with me. It's not that I think that there's something. For me, I usually internalize it in a way where it's like, I haven't gotten it yet. I don't get it yet. You know, and someday I will, because there's so much music. When I was young, I hated what would be known as fusion. I couldn't stand it. I didn't want synthesizers anywhere near jazz, and I was like very purist about it. And now, you know, at some point in time, but I would rant and rave about it. Yeah. I was like one of those, you know, I was a jerk about it. And then I grew up, and then I fell in love with, somewhere along the way, I fell in love with Weather Report. And now I'm like a totally, you know, most of the jazz that I listen to is happened after, you know, 1970. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that experience kind of, now I realize like, well, it just wasn't my time. I had to grow up. I had to have a different experience. I had to, you know, sure. My palate kind of had to be refined, so to speak. Yeah. So, honestly, when I'm working on a record, what I don't want to do, I try not to avoid listening to music. I don't want to be listening to, yeah, because I mean, to me, I fundamentally can't help but hear building blocks in songs, you know. And it doesn't necessarily take me out of the experience of enjoying a song, but I can't help but hear a song and analyze the chord changes in it and think about the tempo and the meter and all the mechanics of the song. And I don't like, I try not to, I don't want to be like halfway thinking about, I want to be conscious with what I'm trying to, I don't want those things to kind of creep in, yeah. Unintentionally. If they're going to creep in, I want it to be intentional. I want to like take an idea and then twist it around and rearrange it and try to do something new with it. But what I kind of don't want those ideas like knocking around in my head in like a quasi-conscious manner.
Speaking about writing and things like that, how do you pick the samples that you're using? Are you just like, is there hours of rifling through records and things like that? And how do you determine which songs are going to be like an instrumental track and which ones you're going to collab with someone or put vocals on? I mean, there's a lot to that.
There really is. And it's a thing that I, you know, when it comes to sample-based stuff, it's one of these things where it's so labor-intensive that I don't, it becomes less and less of my process the older I get.
Yeah.
Just because it's the kind of thing that it's really hard to do that full speed and do any other kind of composition you know, approaches at the same time. For me, I have a hard time doing that. So A New Theory was almost, that's all. Most of that song, 80% of that song is sample based. But that was the thing. But it was a thing where I really had to be conscious about it, and I had to know exactly what I was looking for going in.
Sure.
And even then, it was really, really, basically there's like these bends, these pitch bends, in this like all of those stabs in it that repeat, they're either, you know, pitch bending up or down. Those were all I just went through, and I was looking for as many different, you know, like one note sustains that would happen at the end of a song where a band would just hit a note, and then what I'd do is I would pitch the turntable either up or down. I would let that part of it play, and then I'd either turn the turntable off, or I'd really gently pitch it up. So that's how you hear that. What on the original recordings were just a sustained note. No, that's a synth-based thing.
Okay,
but the things are bing, 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 bing. Originally, those weren't bing. They were just bing.
Okay,
they were just one, you know, sustained pitch. And that was a thing where I had to go through records and find a bunch of different ones and kind of make composites of them. But yeah, it's you know, it gets exhausting. There was a second half to that question.
How you determine which song is going to be instrumental?
Oh yeah. You know, you for me, it usually kind of I'm listening to the song more than I'm trying to, you know, jam a square peg into a round hole.
Sure.
I mean, certain things I just feel like they're obvious. Like I look at Piece of What as a thing where, like, once the instrumental was on its way to being what it was going to be, it just kind of seemed obvious to me, like, this is going to be a more interesting piece of music if this instrumental is working against a vocal that is, you know, you can just kind of see how the,
sure,
you know, I can visualize how the building blocks of the song are going to fit together best. And that was a scenario where it's like, well, that's where this is really going to work best, is in a kind of verse chorus-y type of manner with featuring a vocalist. And then other things like A New Theory, I could probably pitch that to rappers for 6 months and not gotten any response, and no, I'm not touching that, you know.
Yeah.
So then it kind of becomes obvious. Then, you know, let's shorten it down. Let's put stuff in it to keep your attention. Do things that, you know, then you can kind of use that to your advantage. And there's all these little breaks in that song that, you know, I wouldn't do that type of thing. I wouldn't put those in a song that was intended to feature a vocalist. But when you have something that's instrumental and it's kind of drawing attention to itself, now you can afford to do kind of abstract, weird things that are jarring, that would take you out of the experience of focusing on a vocalist's performance.
So you've obviously been a record collector, vinyl collector, for quite a while to be able to establish the collection that you have and all that. Has the increase in popularity in vinyl had any impact on, like, you being able to dig through the racks to find your samples or find whatever you're looking for?
Not in that sense. It's definitely, as a guy running a label, it's been a huge challenge.
Really?
Yeah, man. It's because the lead time now on manufacturing is, like, it's crazy. So it's just become a mess in terms of, it's, those lead times have gotten, you know, they've gone from like 2 months to 3 months to 4 months to 6 months. Yeah, so that has been a big challenge.
And isn't it like there's only like two plants pressing vinyl or something crazy like that?
Yeah.
Or something. It's nuts.
There's several in the States,
okay,
but it has a bottleneck for sure, you know, because for so long the music industry cratered, and then almost immediately, you know, relatively speaking, right after that, there was this massive uptick in a demand for vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, what can you do? I'm glad that people are wanting records, and hopefully people continue to want records, and hopefully there's, you know, they can compensate on the manufacturing side, so we'll see.
And also, speaking of records, I don't know if you're going to want to talk to this or not. I follow you on Twitter. I was tracking your American Airlines fiasco a few weeks ago. Can you kind of get into that a little bit for those that weren't aware? And then also, I never got an outcome. I want to know what happened with that.
Yeah, everything worked out. Yeah, I posted later in the day a picture of the records in question.
They were okay.
And yeah, they were safe and sound, so the bag was torn up, but yeah, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. I feel kind of silly retreading, but yeah, I just had this kind of, I was at odds with it was a weird thing because I had never had this happen. I fly, so you can either check records or you can carry him on. If they're going to carry him on, they have, it's very clear what they state the size of the bag has to be. So obviously when you're going to carry records on, which is what I started doing like 12 years ago, because if they lose, I can't, that's one thing I can't afford to get lost when I'm on the way to a gig. Right. So by nature, it has to be a smaller bag. It's soft. It's not intended to be checked, you know. And this is all because it's, I made sure that it falls within the guidelines of what can be carried on. So this person at the gate basically, for whatever reason, she said she insisted that I check the bag. She was like, check something. And I had a backpack with like just a simple, that laptop back on my backpack. On my back, and the record bag that I have been putting under seats and overhead, you know, luggage compartments for over 12 years now. The exact precise bag. So I was like, I knew, and this happens all the time. You know, they'll say, oh, that's not going to fit. And I was like, oh, trust me, it'll fit. And the response is always, okay, if it doesn't fit, you got to bring it back up here and we're going to check it. And I would say, yeah, sure, that's fine. And every time, it fits. Because I can put it right in the thing. They have a thing, metal box right there that says, if it's bigger than this, you have to check it.
Yeah.
And so the woman was like, you're going to have to check that. It's not going to fit. And I'm like, no, it'll fit. Trust me, watch. And I stick it in the metal thing and she's like, that's not going to fit under your seat. You're going to have to check it. And it was really surreal because now we're having a conversation about a bag that's literally in the metal compartment thing that's there to illustrate the size, you know, to determine the size of your bag. And she's like, so we're not quite shouting at each other, but we're getting close. And at a point she's like, if you say one more thing about this, I'm pulling you off this flight.
Oh my God.
And at that point I was like, this is just too weird and too surreal. What do I do? And I was like, well, if she pulls me off this flight, where does this go? Am I going to get pulled off the next flight?
Yeah.
How long am I stuck here?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm trying to talk to a manager and she's just referring me to her other person at the gate. and the guy at the gate is saying the same thing. And he's like, it's really for your own good.
Oh, come on.
What are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense, dude. So I let it go and checked the bag and, you know, I was freaked out for 8 hours and everything was fine. No records were destroyed, but it was just a weird, harrowing experience. But
so. I'd like to talk about A Beautiful Mind. For people that don't know RJD2 aren't familiar, you've more than likely heard this song. It was the theme for Mad Men, correct? I want to know, was that a standalone track beforehand, or was that something you kind of put together for them?
So I put out a record with AC Alone. There's a rapper out in that came out of this group called Freestyle Fellowship, and I was always a big fan of his. And I had a chance to make a record with him and in the mid to early 2000s, and so we made this album, and it came out on Decon. It was called A Beautiful Mind. The song was called A Beautiful Mind. It was from the record, was called Magnificent City. And then after that, the vocal version of the album came out. We put out an instrumental version of it. And apparently, as I'm told, Matt Weiner, they used one of the songs as a bumper piece on NPR, and he heard it there and decided he needed... the instrumental version, he decided he had to have it for the show that he was developing. This was in 2006. The album hadn't been out for very long.
Okay.
And that started the process of the, you know, us talking about, you know, the negotiations, if you will, for them using that song for the intro. But the show hadn't even aired yet. So it wasn't your normal licensing situation in many regards. But it was, they only had a pilot for a show that hadn't aired, and we didn't know anything about what we just had like a loose description of what the show was about.
Okay.
So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Turned out pretty well for you. Yeah.
I'm happy to have been, narrowly, I came very close. The first few times that they asked about it, I was like, whoa, we'll license it, but. I'm not going to get into a long story, but it came very close to not happening at all on my side because they didn't want to license it. They wanted to own the publishing outright. I'm super happy to have been a part of the show.
Yeah,
you know,
awesome.
It's a cool show and became this, you know,
It seems to fits really well, stuff, too, so. Bizarrely. Like, it's funny that you had it already written, and then for what they had, I don't know, it just fits the theme of the show, the feel of the show really well.
Yeah, it's a common thing I've found that when in the world of, like, film and TV and ads and stuff, once people arrive at deciding, like, this is the thing, they very often, there's kind of this synergy type of thing that happens between the audio and the visual where it becomes this is really, really common. It becomes impossible for people to envision the visual without the audio.
Absolutely.
So this is a really common thing in the world of licensing where, like, people temp music in and they're like, oh, I can't imagine anything. They watch it enough that they're like, oh, it works so well. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anything else. And then it becomes very difficult for the creatives working on the spot if they can't license the song. Mm-hmm. Because they're kind of forced into a situation where, like, their brain is telling them nothing else is going to work here.
I know before, you seem to be a DIY guy. I've seen things of you building gear and this crazy thing that spins on you as you're playing it. So I want to talk about that a little bit, like you building gear. And also, speaking of gear, we talked off the mic a little bit about a time where you playing a song and all of a sudden, your gear breaks. Like, how often does something like that come up? And I guess what's kind of led you to being a DIY enthusiast?
I got into that world from my interest in synthesizers. So when I was touring on the Since We Last Spoke record, I had been increasingly interested in vintage synths. Mm-hmm. And so I picked up a couple synthesizers on that tour, and I right away found that there's when something's 30 years old, you either need to know how to learn how to fix it yourself, or it's going to spend 6 months at a tech's, shop. And I just didn't make sense to me to spend a bunch of money and have something gone for, months and months and months, and I couldn't use it. So I was like, let me just see what it, So I went down that path of figuring out how to restore older synthesizers. And then I continued buying them, and you kind of little by little you just get more acclimated with it, and you're buying tools for the job and materials and so on and so forth. And after doing that for a while, after about 5 years of doing that, I kind of took the plunge into building modular synthesizer modules. And there's a whole world, we're kind of like in the heyday or golden era of that. Because there's a lot of people that are interested in it, and there's a lot of people that are putting out kits for people to build. So that, to me, it's all just kind of jumbled together, like repairing stuff, building stuff. It all just comes out of the same need of, like, I want something, I want it to work, I want it to work all the time. So the spinning controller thing was something that was just like, well, here's a problem, I can't take a thing out. I'd like to be able to, don't ask why, I'd like to be able to wear a thing that I could, play like as a remote for the NPC. And then I was like, well, it'd be cool if it was wireless. And then that just kind of sets you down the path of, and that build wasn't, in hindsight, it wasn't overly complicated. The suit, just while we're on the subject, the suit that you're going to see tonight is, that was possibly the most in-depth, challenging DIY project I've done in a long time. So
I'm excited for the suit. I haven't seen the suit yet. That's news to me.
I'm stoked right now.
I don't want to keep you all day, so just a few more questions for you. But I feel like there's a perception of DJs today, right, that are just button pushers. You know what I mean? How do you feel about that perception? Because I know you're not that. And for those that are, I mean, what's your attitude towards that?
I'm definitely not one to pass judgment, and I don't, I also don't feel like if I'm being totally honest with myself, I'm not that invested in the quote unquote culture of DJing as a whole, where I feel like it needs to be protected or preserved or anything like that. I obviously came out of a world of, I was a hip hop producer, DJ before that, and so I came out of a time when there was no, well before Serato, and there were no, there wasn't a laptop that you could rely on, and then it got to a point where people skipped right over that, and then it just went straight to, other things, not even using turntables or any whatever, and it's all fine, it's all well and good. I have no complaints about it. You know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do because I need it to be, I need the fluidity and the challenge of there being the possibility for mistakes, or I can't, I don't feel good going out on the road. If I'm being totally honest, it would just be too boring to me. Yeah. Like life's just too short for me to not have that level of, you know, there's got to be some risk baked into the thing for me. But, you know, to each his own. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a great mindset. What are you doing when you're not making music or making beats or whatever?
Playing with my kid. Yeah, I got a 4-year-old boy now, so he's that's my in a great way, in the best way possible. Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of my main. These days, it's probably more of a focus than the music thing. If I'm being totally honest, I probably spend more time parenting than. Working on music, but you know, there's room for both. So it's that, and you know, I like tools. I like to build stuff, whether it's music or not. I mean, the same drive to like make a song is the same thing that, you know, to restore a car or something like that, or build a, you know, a table or so on and so forth.
For sure.
And when you come into Chicago, are there any like must see spots or must go to spots for you?
Oh man. You know, it's been so, this is so sad. It's been so long. Friends, there's people. Those are the must see things for me right now in Chicago, are people. There's awesome food and there's awesome records and I love the city. It has been so long since I've had a couple days off in Chicago to just
enjoy.
Yeah. That sounds like a dream come true right now. I would love to just explore and eat food for 2 days straight. That would be.
But you gotta work.
Yeah, maybe someday. Maybe someday soon, hopefully. I need a vacation.
RJ, we really appreciate your time. Looking forward to the show tonight. Thank you for everything, and best of luck on the road ahead.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod, and check us out on Instagram @SoundSessionsWGN.